dog cage, which I was about to discover was terribly ironic. The little boy rocked back and forth, whimpering a primitive, self-soothing lullaby. He was filthy with his own feces. There was food all over his face, and his diaper was heavy, soaked with urine. He was being treated for severe pneumonia, but he resisted all procedures and had to be held down to draw blood. He tore out his IVs. He yelled and screamed at staff, and he threw his food. The closest this hospital had to a psychiatric unit was the PICU, where the ratio of staff to patients was very high, so Justin had been transferred. There, they had jerry-rigged his crib-cage arrangement. And once placed in the cage, the boy began to throw feces and anything else he could get his hands on. That's when they called psychiatry. Over the years, I had learned that it is not a good idea to take a child by surprise. Unpredictability and the unknown make everyone feel anxious and therefore less able to process information accurately. Also, and importantly for clinical evaluation, the more anxious someone is, the harder it is for him to accurately recall and describe his feelings, thoughts, and history. But most critically, when a child is anxious, it is much more difficult to form a positive relationship, the true vehicle for all therapeutic change. I had learned the power of first impressions as well. I could get a much better sense of a child's prognosis if he had a favorable or at least a neutral first impression of me. So rather than just start asking questions of an unsuspecting and usually frightened and disoriented child, I found it was best to give him a chance to meet me first. We'd have a brief, humorous, or engaging conversation. I'd let him size me up a little, provide a clear, simple explanation of what I wanted to learn from him, and then leave him alone for a while to process that information. I'd assure him that he was in control. The child didn't have to say anything if he didn't want to. If any topic came up that he didn't wish to share with me, I'd tell him just let me know and I would change the subject. Any time he decided to stop, the conversation was over. Over the years, I've had only one adolescent girl say that she did not want to talk. But later that week, she told the staff that the only person she would speak with was the psychiatry guy with the curly hair. When I saw Justin, I knew this case was going to be different. I needed to know more about him before I could approach him. I took his chart, went back to the nurse's station, and read his old records, occasionally glancing over to watch him rock with his knees up by his chin, his arms around his legs. He was humming or moaning to himself, and every few minutes he would let out a loud, angry-sounding shriek. The PICU staff had become used to this. No one even glanced his way anymore. As I read through his records, it became clear that Justin's early life had not been normal. Justin's mother was a 15-year-old girl who left him with her own mother permanently when he was 2 months old. Justin's grandmother, by all accounts, was a kind-hearted, nurturing woman who adored her grandchild. Unfortunately, she was also morbidly obese and had related health problems that made her very ill. When Justin was about 11 months old, she was hospitalized and died several weeks later. During her illness, her live-in boyfriend, Arthur, a pseudonym, babysat for Justin. Baby Justin's behavior became difficult, surely a result of losing both his mother and his grandmother in such a short time. Arthur, still grieving himself, didn't know what to do with a crying, tantruming young child, and being in his late 60s, he wasn't physically or mentally prepared for such a challenge. He called Child Protective Services, seeking a permanent placement for the boy, who, after all, was not even a relative. CPS apparently felt the boy was safe, and asked if Arthur would keep Justin while they found alternate placement. He agreed. Arthur was a passive man, in general, and patient. He assumed that CPS would get around to finding a new home for Justin. But CPS is a reactive, crisis-focused agency, and with no one putting pressure on it to do so, it didn't act. Arthur was not malicious, but he was ignorant about the needs of children. He made a living as a dog breeder, and sadly applied that knowledge to the care of the baby. He began keeping Justin in a dog cage. He made sure the baby was fed and changed, but he rarely spoke to him, played with him, or did any of the other normal things parents do to nurture their children. Justin lived in that cage for 5 years, spending most of his days with only dogs as his companions. If we could witness a child's moments of comfort, curiosity, exploration, and reward, and his moments of terror, humiliation, and deprivation, we would know so much more about him, who he is, and who he is likely to become. The brain is an historical organ, a reflection of our personal histories. Our genetic gifts will only manifest themselves if we get the proper types of developmental experience appropriately timed. Early in life, these experiences are controlled primarily by the adults around us. As I read through Justin's chart, I began to imagine his life as it unfolded. At the age of 2, Justin had been given a diagnosis of static encephalopathy, meaning that he had severe brain damage of unknown origin that was unlikely to improve. He had been taken to the doctor because he was severely developmentally delayed. He was unable to walk or say even a few words by the time most children are actively exploring toddlers who have begun to speak in sentences. Tragically, when Arthur had brought Justin in for medical checkups, no one inquired about his living situation, and no one took a good developmental history. The boy had been tested for various physical ailments, and his brain had been scanned, revealing atrophy, shrinkage, of the cerebral cortex, and enlargement of the fluid-filled ventricles in the center of the brain. In fact, his brain looked like that of someone with advanced Alzheimer's disease. His head circumference was so small that he was below the second percentile for children his age. Back then, many doctors were still unaware of the damage that neglect alone can do to the brain. They assumed that something so clearly visible on scans had to be evidence of a genetic defect or intrauterine insult, such as exposure to toxins or disease. They couldn't imagine that early environment alone could have such profound physical effects. But studies done by our group and others later found that orphans who were left to languish in institutional settings without receiving enough affection and individual attention do indeed have visibly smaller head sizes and tinier brains. The brains show obvious abnormalities, virtually identical to those seen in Justin. Unfortunately, as in Laura's case, Justin's problems were exacerbated by a fragmented medical system. Over the years, even though he'd been given tests as complicated as high-tech brain scans and chromosomal analysis to look for genetic problems, he rarely saw the same doctor twice. No one followed his case over time or learned about his living situation. By age 5, a repeat screening showed he had made minimal progress in fine and large motor, behavioral, cognitive, or speech and language capabilities. He still couldn't walk or talk. To the doctors who didn't know about the deprivation the child was experiencing, it appeared as if most of his brain-mediated capabilities just did not work properly. They assumed that Justin's static encephalopathy was due to some, as of yet unknown and untreatable, birth defect. The unspoken conclusion with children exhibiting this kind of severe brain damage is that they do not respond to therapeutic interventions. In essence, the doctors had told Arthur that the boy was permanently brain damaged and might never be able to care for himself, so he wasn't given any incentive to seek further help. Whether because of this medical pessimism or because of his irregular care, Justin was never provided any speech therapy, physical therapy, or occupational therapy, and no in-home social services were offered to his elderly caregiver. Left to his own devices, Arthur made caregiving decisions that fit his understanding of child rearing. He'd never had children of his own, and had been a loner for most of his life. He was very limited himself, probably with mild mental retardation. He raised Justin as he raised his other animals, giving him food, shelter, discipline, and episodic, direct compassion. Arthur wasn't intentionally cruel. He'd take both Justin and the dogs out of their cages daily for regular play and affection. But he didn't understand that Justin acted like an animal because he had been treated as one, and so when the boy didn't obey, back into the cage he went. Most of the time, Justin was simply neglected. I was the first medical professional Arthur had told about his child-rearing practices because, unfortunately for Justin, I was the first to ask. After interviewing Arthur, reading Justin's charts, and observing his behavior, I realized that it was possible that some of the boy's problems were not due to a complete absence of potential. Maybe he didn't speak because he had rarely been spoken to. Maybe, unlike a normal child who hears some 3 million words by age 3, he'd been exposed to far fewer. Maybe he didn't stand and walk because no one had coaxed him with their hand out to steady and encourage him. Maybe he didn't know how to eat with utensils because he had never held any in his hands. I decided to approach Justin with the hope that his deficits were indeed due to a lack of appropriate stimulation, essentially a lack of opportunity and not lack of capacity. The nursing staff watched as I walked carefully toward his crib. "He's gonna start throwing," one of them said, cynically. I tried to move in slow motion. I wanted him to watch me. I figured that the novelty of my measured pace, in contrast to the typical hurried motion in the PICU, would catch his attention. I did not look at him. I knew eye contact might be threatening, just as it is for many animals. I pulled the curtain surrounding his crib partially closed, so that all he could see was me or the nurse's station. That way he would be less distracted by the children in the adjacent beds. I tried to imagine the world from his perspective. He was still ill, his pneumonia only partially resolved. He looked terrified and confused. He had no understanding of this new, chaotic realm in which he'd been placed. At least his home in the dog kennel had been familiar. He'd known the dogs around him and knew what to expect from them. Also, I was sure he was hungry, since he had thrown away most of his food over the last 3 days. As I got close, he sneered, scrambled around the small space of his crib, and gave out one of his screeches. I stood still. Then I slowly started to take off my white coat, letting it slip to the floor. He stared at me. I slowly undid my tie and pulled it off. I rolled up the sleeves of my shirt. With each action, I took one small step closer. I did not speak as I moved. I tried to be as non-threatening as possible, no quick movements, no eye contact, trying to speak in a low, melodic, rhythmic tone, almost like a lullaby. I approached him as one would a terrified baby or a frightened animal. "My name is Dr. Perry, Justin. You don't know what is happening here, do you? I will try to help you, Justin. See, I am just taking off my white coat. That's okay, right? Now, let me come a bit closer. Far enough? Okay. Let's see what might work here. I will take off my tie. Ties are not familiar to you, I bet. Let me do that." He stopped moving around the crib. I could hear his breathing, a rapid, wheezy grunt. He had to be starving. I noticed a muffin on a lunch tray, far out of his reach, but still within his view. I moved toward it. He grunted louder and faster. I took the muffin, broke a small piece off, and slowly put it in my mouth and chewed deliberately, trying to indicate pleasure and satisfaction. So good, Justin. Do you want some? I kept talking and reached my arm out. I was getting closer. In fact, I was close enough now for him to reach my outstretched hand and the food. I stood still, keeping up my banter and holding the muffin out to him. It seemed like hours, but within 30 seconds he tentatively reached out of the crib. He stopped halfway to the muffin and pulled his arm back in. He seemed to be holding his breath. And then, suddenly, He grabbed at the muffin and pulled it into the crib. He scooted over to the furthest corner and watched me. I stood in the same place, smiled, and tried to bring some light into my voice. "Good, Justin. That is your muffin. It's okay. It's good." He started to eat. I waved goodbye and walked slowly back to the nurse's station. "Well, just wait a minute. He'll be screaming and throwing things again," said one of the nurses, who seemed almost disappointed that he hadn't displayed his bad behavior for me. "I expect so," I said, on my way out. From what I'd learned so far about the effects of neglect on the brain, I knew that the only way to find out whether Justin had unexpressed potential or had no capacity for further development was to see if his neural systems could be shaped by patterned, repetitive experience in a safe and predictable environment. But I hadn't yet learned the best way to structure this experience. I did know that the first thing I needed to do was decrease the chaos and sensory overload surrounding Justin. We moved him to one of the PICU private rooms. Then we minimized the number of staff interacting with him. We began physical, occupational, and speech-language therapy. We had one of our psychiatric staffers spend time with him every day, and I made daily visits as well. The improvement was remarkably rapid. Each succeeding day was better for Justin. Every day he appeared to feel safer. He stopped throwing food and smearing feces. He started to smile. He showed clear signs of recognition and comprehension of verbal commands. We realized that he had received some social stimulation and affection from the dogs he'd lived with. Dogs are incredibly social animals and have a sophisticated social hierarchy in their packs. At times he responded to unfamiliar people much like a scared dog will, tentatively approaching, backing off, and then moving forward again. As the days went by, he began to be affectionate with me and several other staff members. He even started to show signs of a sense of humor. For example, he knew that throwing poop made the staff crazy. So once, when someone gave him a candy bar, he let the chocolate melt into his hands, and he raised his arm as though he were about to throw it. The people around him moved back, and then he broke into a big, hearty laugh. It was this primitive sense of humor which demonstrated that he understood the effects of his actions on others and connected with them that rapidly gave me hope about his capacity for change. At first, however, my colleagues thought I was wasting hospital resources by asking that physical therapists try to help him stand to improve his large and fine motor strength and control. But within a week, Justin was sitting in a chair and standing with assistance. By 3 weeks, he had taken his first steps. Then an occupational therapist came to help him with fine motor control and fundamentals of self-care, dressing himself, using a spoon, brushing his teeth. Although many children who suffer this kind of deprivation develop a highly tuned sense of smell and often try to sniff and lick their food and people, Justin's sniffing was particularly pronounced and may have had to do with his life among the dogs. He had to be taught that this isn't always appropriate. During this time, speech and language therapists helped him begin to speak, providing the exposure to words he'd missed in his childhood. His once dormant, undeveloped neural networks began to respond to these new repetitive patterns of stimulation. His brain seemed to be like a sponge, thirsty for the experiences it required, and eagerly soaking them up. After 2 weeks, Justin was well enough to be discharged from the hospital and placed in a foster family. For the next few months, he made remarkable progress. This was the most rapid recovery from severe neglect that we had yet seen. It changed my perspective on the potential for change following early neglect. I became much more hopeful about the prognosis for neglected children. 6 months later, Justin was transferred to a foster family who lived much further away from the hospital. While we offered our consultation services to his new clinical team, ultimately we lost track of him in the massive caseload that our group was beginning to attract. But we often talked about Justin when we consulted with other families who had adopted severely neglected children. He had made us reevaluate how we assessed and treated such children. We now knew that at least some of them could improve more dramatically than we'd previously dared to dream. About 2 years after Justin's hospital stay, a letter came to the clinic from a small town, a brief note from the foster family giving us an update on the little boy. He was continuing to do well, rapidly hitting developmental milestones that no one had ever expected him to reach. Now 8, he was ready to start kindergarten. Enclosed was a picture of Justin all dressed up, holding a lunchbox, wearing a backpack, and standing next to a school bus. On the back of the note, in crayon, Justin himself had written, "Thank you, Dr. Perry. Justin." I cried. Taking what I'd learned from Justin's case, that patterned, repetitive experience in a safe environment can have an enormous impact on the brain, I began to integrate Mama P's lessons about the importance of physical affection and stimulation into our care. One of the next cases that would help us develop the neurosequential approach was that of a young teenager whose early life experience turned out to have been similar to that which had started Leon on his destructive and ultimately murderous path. Like Leon, Connor had an intact nuclear family and an early childhood that on the surface did not seem traumatic. Connor's parents were both successful, college-educated businesspeople. Like Leon, Connor had an above-average IQ, but unlike him, he did well in school. When we did a simple review of his previous psychiatric treatment, we noted that he had been given at various points more than a dozen different neuropsychiatric diagnoses, starting with autism, then ranging from pervasive developmental disorder, childhood schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, ADHD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, major depression, anxiety disorder, and more. When the 14-year-old was first brought in to see me, he was labeled with the diagnoses of intermittent explosive disorder, psychotic disorder, and attention deficit disorder. He was taking 5 psychiatric medications and was being treated by a psychoanalytically trained therapist. He walked with an uneven, awkward gait. When he was anxious or distressed, he would sway, rhythmically flex his hands, and hum to himself in a tuneless drone that set most people's nerves on edge. He would frequently sit and rock back and forth, just like Justin had when I'd first seen him in that cage crib. He had no friends. He hadn't become a bully like Leon, but he was a favored target for them. Connor had been placed in a social skills group in an attempt to address his isolation and poor relational skills, but so far, it had been an utter failure. It was, I would soon discover, as though the group had been trying to teach an infant calculus. Connor was certainly relationally odd, but he did not show the classic symptoms of either autism or schizophrenia. His behaviors were similar to children with those conditions, but he did not, for example, have the mind blindness and indifference to relationships that mark autism, or the disordered thought common to schizophrenia. When I examined him, I could see that he sought to engage with other people, which is rare among those with genuine autism. He was socially inept, to be sure, but he did not have the complete disinterest in social connection that is essentially the hallmark of autism. The boy was also on so many medications that no one could tell which of his symptoms were related to his original problems and which were caused by medication side effects. I decided to stop the drugs. If medication turned out to be necessary, I would reintroduce it. Connor's peculiar symptoms and their lack of concordance with typical cases of autism or schizophrenia reminded me of those I'd seen in other children who had suffered early trauma or neglect, like Justin. In particular, I suspected from the curious slanting gait that whatever had gone wrong had started early in infancy, because coordinated walking relies on a well-regulated midbrain and brainstem, regions crucial for coordinating the stress response. Since the brainstem and midbrain are among the earliest regions to organize during development, if something had gone wrong here, it had probably gone wrong in the first year of life. I took a careful developmental history and questioned Connor's mother, Jane, a pseudonym, about her son's early childhood and about her own as well. She was a bright woman, but anxious and clearly near the end of her rope. Her own childhood hadn't been troubled. She had been an only child brought up by loving parents. Unfortunately for Connor, however, she didn't live near extended family or spend much time babysitting as a teenager. As a result, until she had her own child, she had little experience with infants and toddlers. It's common in our mobile modern society to have fewer offspring, live further away from our families, and move in an increasingly age-segregated world, and therefore many of us aren't around children enough to learn about how they should behave at each stage of development. Furthermore, our public education includes no content or training on child development, caregiving, or the basics of brain development. The result is a kind of child illiteracy, which would unfortunately play a large role in what went wrong for Connor, just as it did for Leon. A few years before their son's birth, Jane and her husband Mark, a pseudonym, moved from New Jersey to New Mexico to set up a new business, which thrived. Now that they were financially set, the couple decided to try for a child, and soon Jane became pregnant. She received excellent prenatal care, had a normal delivery, and the child was born robust and healthy. But their family business was so demanding that Jane returned to the office just a few weeks after having her baby. Jane had heard horror stories about daycare, so she and her husband decided to hire a nanny. Coincidentally, a cousin of Jane's had recently moved to the community and was looking for work, so hiring her seemed to be the ideal solution to both of their problems. Unfortunately, unbeknownst to Jane and Mark, the cousin took another job just after agreeing to work for them. Wanting to make extra money, she didn't tell Jane or Mark that she was leaving the child on his own and working another job. She fed and changed the baby in the morning, left for work, fed and changed him at lunchtime, and then returned just before his parents came home from their jobs. She worried about diaper rash or about the possibility of a fire or other danger while the child was on his own, but not about how damaging her actions could be. This cousin was even more ignorant of child development than Jane was. She didn't realize that infants need affection and attention just as much as they need nutrition, hydration, dry clothes, and shelter. Jane told me she felt guilty about returning to work so soon. She described how, for the first 2 weeks after she returned to the office, Connor's cries as she left him were terribly distressing. But after that, he stopped crying, so Jane thought everything was fine. "My baby was content," she told me, describing how even when she accidentally stuck him with a safety pin, Connor didn't even whimper. "He never cried," she said, emphatically, not aware that if a baby never cries, this is as much a sign of potential problems as crying too much can be. Again, she was stymied by ignorance of basic child development. Like Maria, she thought that a quiet baby meant a happy baby. Within a few months, however, Jane began to suspect that something was wrong. Connor didn't seem to be maturing as fast as her friends' babies did. He wasn't sitting up or turning over or crawling at the ages that others reach those milestones. Concerned about his lack of progress, she took him to the family's pediatrician, who was excellent at recognizing and treating physical diseases, but didn't know much about how to check for mental and emotional difficulties. She didn't have children of her own, so she was not personally familiar with their psychological development, and like most doctors, hadn't been given much education on it. The doctor also knew the parents well, so she had no reason to suspect abuse or neglect. Consequently, she didn't ask, for example, whether Connor cried or about how he responded to people. She simply told Jane that babies develop at different rates and tried to reassure her that he would catch up soon. One day, however, when Connor was about 18 months old, Jane came home from work sick. Her house was dark, so she assumed the nanny had taken the child out. There was a terrible smell coming from Connor's room. The door was partway open, so she peeked in. She found her son sitting in the dark, alone, with no toys, no music, no nanny, and a full dirty diaper. Jane was horrified. When she confronted her cousin, the woman confessed that she had been leaving Connor and going to the other job. Jane fired the cousin and quit her job to stay home with the baby. She thought she dodged the bullet. She thought that because he hadn't been kidnapped, harmed in a fire, or become physically ill, the experience would have no lasting effects. She didn't connect his increasingly odd behavior with over a year of near daily neglect. As he grew socially isolated and began to engage in peculiar repetitive behaviors, no one in the mental health system, no one in the school system, not one of the special education teachers or occupational therapists or counselors to whom he was sent, discovered Connor's history of early neglect. Hundreds of thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours were spent fruitlessly trying to treat his various disorders. The result was this 14-year-old boy, rocking and humming to himself, friendless and desperately lonely and depressed. A boy who didn't make eye contact with other people, who still had the screaming, violent temper tantrums of a 3- or 4-year-old, a boy who desperately needed the stimulation that his brain had missed during the first months of life. When Mama P had rocked and held the traumatized and neglected children she cared for, she'd intuitively discovered what would become the foundation of our neurosequential approach. These children needed patterned, repetitive experiences appropriate to their developmental needs, needs that reflect the age at which they'd missed important stimuli or had been traumatized, not their current chronological age. When she sat in a rocking chair cuddling a 7-year-old, she was providing the touch and rhythm that he'd missed as an infant, experience necessary for proper brain growth. A foundational principle of brain development is that the neural systems organize and become functional in a sequential manner. Furthermore, the organization of a less mature region depends, in part, upon incoming signals from lower, more mature regions. If one system doesn't get what it needs when it needs it, those that rely upon it may not function well either, even if the stimuli that the later developing system needs are being provided appropriately. The key to healthy development is getting the right experiences in the right amounts at the right time. Part of the reason for Justin's rapid response to our therapy, I soon recognized, was that he had had nurturing experiences during his first year of life before his grandmother had died. This meant his lowest and most central brain regions had been given a good start. If he'd been raised in a cage from birth, his future might have been far less hopeful. It worried me that Connor, like Leon, had suffered neglect virtually from birth to 18 months. The one hope was that during the evenings and weekend hours when his parents were caring for him, there was at least some exposure to nurturing sensory experiences. Drawing on these insights, we decided that we would systematize our approach to match the developmental period at which the damage had first started. By looking carefully at Connor's symptoms and his developmental history, we hoped we could figure out which regions had sustained the most damage and target our interventions appropriately. We would then use enrichment experiences and targeted therapies to help the affected brain areas in the order in which they were affected by neglect and trauma, hence the name neurosequential. If we could document improved functioning following the first set of interventions, we would begin the second set appropriate for the next brain region and developmental stage until hopefully he would get to the point where his biological age and his developmental age would match. In Connor's case, it was clear that his problems had started in early infancy, when the lower and most central regions of the brain are actively developing. These systems respond to rhythm and touch. The brainstem's regulatory centers control heartbeat, the rise and fall of neurochemicals and hormones in the cycle of day and night, the beat of one's walk, and other patterns that must maintain a rhythmic order to function properly. Physical affection is needed to spur some of the region's chemical activity. Without it, as in Laura's case, physical growth, including the growth of the head and brain, can be retarded. Like Leon and others who have suffered early neglect, Connor couldn't stand to be touched. At birth, human touch is a novel and initially stressful stimulus. Loving touch is yet to be connected to pleasure. It is in the arms of a present, loving caregiver that the hours upon hours of touch become familiar and associated with safety and comfort. It seems that when a baby's need for this nurturing touch isn't satisfied, the connection between human contact and pleasure isn't made, and being touched can become actively unpleasant. In order to overcome this and help provide the missing stimuli, we referred Connor to a massage therapist. We would focus first on meeting his needs for skin-to-skin contact. Then we hoped we could further address his asynchronous bodily rhythms. As we saw in Laura's case, touch is critical to human development. Sensory pathways involved in the experience of touch are the first to develop and are the most fully elaborated at birth compared to sight, smell, taste, and hearing. Studies of premature babies find that gentle skin-to-skin contact helps them gain weight, sleep better, and mature more quickly. In fact, preemies who received such gentle massage went home from the hospital almost a week earlier on average. In older children and adults, massage has also been found to lower blood pressure, fight depression, and cut stress by reducing the amount of stress hormones released by the brain. One reason for starting with massage was also strategic. Research finds that parents who learn infant and child massage techniques develop better relationships with their children and feel closer to them. With children who have autism or other conditions that make them seem remote, creating this sense of closeness can often rapidly improve the parent-child relationship and thus escalate the parent's commitment to therapy. This was particularly important in Connor's case because his mother was very anxious about her approach to his treatment. After all, previous psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, and well-meaning neighbors and teachers kept telling her not to indulge his babyish behavior and to ignore his tantrums. He needed more structure and limits, they said, not more cuddles. Everyone else had told her that Connor was immature and must be forced to abandon his primitive self-soothing methods like rocking and humming. Now, we were saying he should be treated gently, which seemed to her overindulgent. In fact, rather than ignore him when his behavior threatened to escalate out of control, as behavioral therapists often suggested, we were saying that he should actually be rewarded with massage. Our approach seemed radically counterintuitive, but because nothing else had helped, she agreed to give it a try. Connor's mom was present during his massage sessions, and we made her an active participant in this part of his therapy. We wanted her there to comfort him and help him if he found the touch stressful. We also wanted her to learn this physically affectionate way of showing her love for her son, to help make up for the hugs and nurturing touches he'd missed during his infancy. This massage approach was gradual, systematic, and repetitive. The initial motions involved Connor's own hands, guided in massaging his arms, shoulders, and trunk. We used a heart rate monitor to track the level of his distress. When his own touch to his own body did not cause changes in his heart rate, we started to use his mother's hands in the same repetitive, gradual massage process. Finally, once his mother's massaging touch was no longer anxiety-provoking, the massage therapist started with more conventional therapeutic massage. The approach was very slow and gentle. The idea was to acclimate Connor to physical touch and, if possible, help him begin to enjoy it. After being taught to give her son neck and shoulder massages, Jane would continue the therapy at home, especially when Connor seemed upset or asked for a massage. We explained to both of them why we were trying this approach. Nothing was forced. We knew that Connor found touch aversive at first, and instructed the therapist to carefully respond to any signals from him that it was too much. She would progress to more intense stimulation only when the previous form and degree of touch had become familiar and safe. She would always start her work by having him use one of his own hands to test the massage. And then, when he was used to that, she began massaging his fingers and hands. She was gradually able to touch and then massage more deeply all of the appropriate bodily zones. Connor's mom was also instructed to follow her son's lead and not push contact if he found it overwhelming. Over the course of 6 to 8 months, Connor gradually began to tolerate and then enjoy physical contact with others. I could tell he was ready to move on to the next phase of treatment when he came up to me and reached his hand out as if to shake my hand. He wound up patting my hand, like a granny would do with a young child, but for him, even a bizarre type of handshake was progress. He would never previously have sought, let alone initiate, physical contact. In fact, he would have actively avoided it. Now it was time to work on his sense of rhythm. It may seem odd, but rhythm is extraordinarily important. If our bodies cannot keep the most fundamental rhythm of life, the heartbeat, we cannot survive. Regulating this rhythm isn't a static, consistent task either. The heart and the brain are constantly signaling each other in order to adjust to life's changes. Our heart rate must increase to power fight or flight, for example, and it must maintain its rhythmic pulse despite the varying demands placed on it. Regulating heart rate during stress and controlling stress hormones are two critical tasks that require that the brain keep proper time. Also, numerous other hormones are rhythmically regulated as well. The brain doesn't just keep one beat, it has many drums, which must all synchronize not only with the patterns of day and night, and in women, with menstrual cycles or phases of pregnancy and nursing, but also with each other. Disturbances of the brain's rhythm-keeping regions are often causes of depression and other psychiatric disorders. This is why sleep problems, in some sense, a misreading of day and night, almost always accompany such conditions. Most people don't appreciate how important these rhythms are in setting the tone for parent-child interactions either. If a baby's primary metronome, his brainstem, doesn't function well, not only will his hormonal and emotional reactions to stress be difficult to modulate, but his hunger and his sleep cycle will be unpredictable as well. This can make parenting him much more difficult. Babies' needs are much easier to read when they reliably occur at predictable times. If their infants become hungry and tired at consistent times, parents can adjust to their demands more easily, reducing stress all around. The implications of poorly regulated bodily rhythms, then, are far greater than one would initially suspect. In the usual course of development, a baby gets into a rhythmic groove that drives these various patterns. The infant's mother cuddles him while he eats, and he is soothed by her heartbeat. In fact, the infant's own heart rhythm may be partly regulated by such contact. Some sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, deaths, according to one theory, occur when babies are out of physical contact with adults, and thus lacking crucial sensory input. Some research even suggests that while in utero, the child's heart can beat in time with his mother's. We do know that maternal heart rate provides the patterned repetitive signals, auditory, vibratory, and tactile, that are crucial to organizing the brainstem and its important stress-regulating neurotransmitter systems. When a baby gets hungry and cries, his levels of stress hormones will move upward, but if mom or dad regularly comes to feed him, they go back down, and over time they become patterned and repetitive thanks to the daily routine. At times, nonetheless, the baby will feel distress and cry, not hungry, not wet, not in discernible physical pain. She will appear inconsolable. When this happens, most parents hug and rock their children, almost instinctively using rhythmic motion and affectionate touch to calm the child. Interestingly, the rate at which people rock their babies is about 80 beats per minute, the same as a normal resting adult heart rate. Faster, and the baby will find the motion stimulating. Slower, and the child will tend to keep crying. To soothe our children, we reattune them physically to the beat of the master timekeeper of life. In fact, some theories of language development suggest that humans learned to dance and sing before we could talk, that music was actually the first human language. It's true that babies learn to understand the musical aspects of speech, the meanings of tones of voice, for example, long before they understand its content. People universally speak to babies, and interestingly to pets, in a high pitch that emphasizes a nurturing, emotional, musical tone. In all cultures, even mothers who cannot carry a tune sing to their babies, suggesting music and song play an important role in infant development. Connor, however, had missed out on music and rhythm when he most needed it. When he cried during the day in his early infancy, no one came to rock him and calm him and bring his stress response systems and hormones back down into the normal range. Though he did get normal care at night and on weekends during his first 18 months, those lonely 8-hour stretches left a lasting mark. In order to make up for what he'd lost, we decided to have Connor participate in a music and movement class that would help him consciously learn to keep a beat, and we hoped help his brain get a more general sense of rhythm. The class itself was nothing unusual. It looked a lot like what you would see in any kindergarten or preschool music class, where children learn to rhythmically clap their hands, to sing together, to repeat sounds in patterns, and tap out beats with objects like blocks or simple drums. Here, of course, the children were older. Unfortunately, we had many other patients who had suffered early neglect with whom to study this approach. At first, Connor was remarkably arrhythmic. He couldn't keep time with the most basic beat. His unconscious rocking had rhythm, but he couldn't deliberately mark out a steady beat or imitate one. I believe this caused the missing early sensory input to the brainstem, which created a weak connection between his higher and lower brain regions. We hoped that by improving his conscious control over rhythm, we could improve these links. Early on, the class was frustrating for him, and Jane became discouraged. At this point, we had been treating Connor for about 9 months. The frequency of his outbursts had lessened, but one day he had a ferocious temper tantrum in school. School officials called Jane at work, demanding that she pick her son up immediately. I had gotten used to regular frantic calls from her several times a week, but this incident brought her despair to a new level. She thought that this meant Connor's treatment had failed, and I had to use all my persuasive powers to keep her committed to this admittedly unusual therapeutic approach. She had seen dozens of very good therapists, psychiatrists, and psychologists, and what we were doing didn't look remotely like any of these previous treatments. She, like so many parents of struggling children, just wanted us to find the right medications and teach Connor to act his age. That weekend, when I saw her number come up on my pager again, I cringed. I didn't want to call her back and learn about yet another setback, or have to talk her out of trying some counterproductive alternate treatment from some new expert someone had told her about. I forced myself to return the call, taking a deep breath to calm myself first. I thought my worst fears were confirmed when it was immediately clear from her tone of voice that she had been weeping. "What's wrong?" I asked quickly. "Oh, Dr. Perry," she said. She paused and seemed to have difficulty going on. My heart sank. But then she continued, "I have to thank you. Today, Connor came up to me, hugged me, and said he loved me." It was the first time he'd ever done that spontaneously. Now Jane, rather than worrying about our approach, became one of our biggest fans. As Connor progressed in the music and movement class, we began to see other positive changes as well. For one, his gait became much more normal, even when he was nervous. Also, over time, the rocking and humming gradually lessened. When we first got to know him, these behaviors were almost constant if he wasn't engaged in a task like schoolwork or playing a game. But now he only reverted to them if something seriously frightened or upset him. I wish all of my patients were as easy to read. Because of this trait, I was able to know instantly if we had gone too far with any challenge and pull back until he could comfortably face it. After he'd been in treatment for about a year, his parents and his teachers began to see the real Connor, not just his weird behavior. After he'd learned to successfully sustain a rhythm, I began parallel play therapy with him. The music and movement class and massage therapy had already improved his behavior. So far, he had had no further tantrums after the incident that had almost prompted Jane to end his therapy with us. But he still lagged in social development, was still being bullied, and still had no friends. A typical treatment for adolescents with such problems is a social skills group like the one Connor had been in when he first came to us. However, because of the developmental lag he'd experienced due to his early neglect, this was still too advanced for him. The first human social interaction begins with normal parent-infant bonding. The child learns how to relate to others in a social situation in which the rules are predictable and easy to figure out. If a child doesn't understand what to do, the parent teaches him. If he persists in misunderstanding, the parent corrects him, repeatedly. Mistakes are expected and rapidly and continually forgiven. The process requires enormous patience. As Mama P reminded me, babies cry, they spit up, they mess. But you expect it and love them anyway. In the next social arena, the child must learn to master the world of peers. Violating social rules is far less tolerated. Here, rules are implicit and are picked up mostly by observation rather than direct instruction. Mistakes can result in long-term negative consequences as peers rapidly reject those who are different, those who don't understand how to connect and respond to others. If someone hasn't developed the ability to understand the clearly defined rules of the parent-child relationship, trying to teach him peer relations is almost impossible. Just as higher motor functions, such as walking, rely upon rhythmic regulation from lower brain areas like the brainstem, more advanced social skills require mastery of elementary social lessons. I had to approach Connor carefully, because at first he was skeptical about me. Talking to shrinks hadn't done him much good, and he found relating to others difficult in general. So I didn't attempt to engage him directly. I gave him control of our interaction. If he wanted to talk to me, I would talk to him. But if he didn't, I would let him be. He came in for therapy and would sit down in my office. I would continue to work at my desk. We simply spent time in the same space. I demanded nothing. He asked for nothing. As he became more comfortable, he became more curious. He'd move a little bit closer to me, and then closer still. And pretty soon he'd come over and stand near me. Finally, after many weeks, he'd ask, "What are you doing?" And I'd say, "I'm working. What are you doing?" "I'm in therapy," he'd say questioningly. "Well, what's therapy to you?" "We sit and talk." "Okay," I'd say. "What do you want to talk about?" "Nothing," he'd reply at first. I'd tell him that that was fine. I was busy, he should do his homework, and I'd do my work. After a few more weeks, however, he said he did want to talk. We sat face to face, and he asked, "Why are we doing this?" This had not been at all like the therapy he was familiar with. So I began to teach him about the brain and brain development. I told him what I thought happened to him when he was an infant. The science made sense to him. And he immediately wanted to know, "What's the next step? What do we do next?" That's when I talked about forming relationships with other people, saying that he didn't seem very good at it. He said emphatically, but with a smile, "I know, I suck." Only then did I start to do explicit social coaching, which he was instantly eager to start. It was harder than I thought it would be. Body language and social cues were unintelligible to Connor. They simply didn't register. Working with Connor, it hit me over and over again how sophisticated and subtle much of human communication is. I told him, for example, that people find eye contact engaging during a social interaction, so it is important to look at people while you listen to them and when you talk to them. He agreed to try it, but this resulted in him staring fixedly at me, just as he'd formerly fixed his gaze on the floor. I said, "Well, you don't want to look at people all the time." "Well, when do I look at them?" I tried to explain that he should look for a little while and then look away, because lasting eye contact is actually a human signal of either aggression or romantic interest, depending on the situation. He wanted to know exactly how long to look, but of course, I couldn't tell him because of how dependent such things are on nonverbal cues and context. I tried telling him to wait 3 seconds, but this resulted in him counting out loud and made matters worse. As we practiced, I rapidly discovered that we use more social cues than I had ever realized, and I had no idea how to teach them. For example, when Connor looked away after initiating eye contact, he would turn his whole face rather than simply moving his eyes. Or he'd look up afterwards, his eye rolling unintentionally, signaling boredom or sarcasm. It was like trying to teach someone from outer space to make human conversation. Eventually, however, he got to the point where he could socially engage, even though he still often seemed a bit robotic. Each step was complicated. Trying to teach him to shake hands properly, for example, resulted in alternately limp fish approaches and too firm grips. Because he didn't read other people's cues very well, he often wasn't aware that he'd said something that hurt someone's feelings, or perplexed them, or seemed frighteningly odd. He was a nice young man. When he came in, he would always say hi to the secretaries and attempt to engage them in conversation. But something about the interaction would be off. Often his wording and tone of voice would be odd, and he wouldn't notice the awkward silences. Once someone asked him where he lived, and he responded, "I just moved," and left it at that. From his tone and short reply, the other person figured that he didn't want to talk. He would seem brusque or weird. Connor didn't understand that he needed to put the person at ease by providing more information. Conversations have a rhythm to them, but Connor didn't yet know how to play along. At one point, too, I tried to address his fashion sense, which was another source of trouble with his peers. Style is partly a reflection of social skills. To be fashionable, you have to observe others and read cues about what's in and what's out, and then discover how to copy them in a way that suits you. The signals are subtle, and a person's choices, in order to be successful, must reflect both individuality and appropriate conformity. Among adolescents, ignoring these signals can be socially disastrous, and Connor was clueless. He'd wear his shirt buttoned all the way up to the neck, for example. One day I suggested not buttoning the top button. He looked at me like I was crazy and asked, "What do you mean?" I responded, "Well, you don't always have to button it." "But there's a button there," he said, uncomprehending. So I took a pair of scissors and cut it off. Jane was not pleased, calling me up to say, "Since when are scissors part of a normal therapeutic intervention?" But as he continued to improve, Jane calmed back down. Connor even made friends with another boy in our treatment program, a teenager who had also suffered neglect and who was at a similar level of emotional development. They'd been in the music and movement class together. When the other boy was frustrated about not being able to keep time, Connor had told him that he'd been just as bad at first and then urged him to stick with it. They bonded even further over, of all things, Pokemon cards. At the time, they were popular with elementary school-age children, but this was the emotional level of these boys' development, even though they were high school sophomores. they tried to share their obsession with their peers, but the other teens, of course, made fun of them. Connor had one final out-of-control incident, incidentally, which was a result of the Pokemon obsession. He was defending his friend from some other adolescents who were teasing him about the cards, trying to tear them up. Jane, of course, panicked when she heard about it. She'd thought I shouldn't encourage the boys in their Pokemon games, fearing just such an incident. I did speak with both of them about when and where to flash their Pokemon cards, but I thought it was better to allow the connection between these two to flourish, since it was giving both boys an opportunity to practice their social skills. I didn't think they'd be able to go from preschool to high school socialization without elementary school-like experiences, such as Pokemon, as intermediate steps, as awkward as I knew they'd be. We explained the situation to the school, and Connor and his friend continued to enjoy Pokemon, but with a bit more discretion. Connor went on to graduate high school and college without further outbursts. He continued his sequential development with just a bit of help from our clinical team. We saw him on breaks from school. He continued to socially mature. I knew the treatment had been a success when Connor, now a computer programmer, sent me an email with the header, "Next Lesson, Girls." Connor is still socially awkward and may always be geeky. However, even though he suffered almost exactly the same kind of neglect during a similar developmental period as Leon did, he never showed anything like the other teens' malicious, sociopathic behavior. He became a victim of bullies, not a bully himself. While he was an outsider, he was not someone filled with hate. His behavior was bizarre and his tantrums appeared threatening, but he didn't attack other children or steal from them or enjoy hurting people. His rages were prompted by his own frustration and anxiety, not by a desire for vengeance or a sadistic wish to make others feel as bad as he did. Was it treatment from us and all of the other clinicians before us that made the difference? Was it important that his family pushed for intervention when he was young? Did it matter that we were able to intervene early in Connor's adolescence? Probably. But did any of that truly count in keeping him from becoming a raging sociopath like Leon? It is, of course, impossible to know.